When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living. I'm your host, Sid Evans, and today I'm talking with an artist who's probably best known as part of the country music duo Sugarland. Jennifer Nettles was born and raised in rural South Georgia, where she got very involved in 4-H, a relationship that's still a big part of her life. She went on to an extraordinary music career, winning a long list of Grammys, CMA Awards, and ACM Awards with Sugarland in the mid-2000s. By 2015, she'd started to work more in film and television, including her roles as Dolly Parton's mother in Coat of Many Colors and Christmas of Many Colors. And now she's the host of a successful dating show called Farmer Wants a Wife. We'll talk about why Jennifer feels like this concept is so different from all the others in the genre, and why she'll always feel connected to the farming community. We'll also hear about her upcoming album, Timeless, her thoughts on the evolution of country music, and what the song Baby Girl means to her 20 years later on this week's Biscuits and Jam. Jennifer Nettles, welcome to Biscuits and Jam.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I love both of those things, so this is exciting.
Well, you're from down there in South Georgia. I mean, you've seen your share of Biscuits and Jam over the years.
I certainly have, and I'm a huge Southern Living fan, so there's that.
Oh, well, thank you. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
It goes both ways. Well, where am I reaching you right now?
I'm at home.
In New York?
Yes.
A long way from South Georgia and from farm country.
A long way from South Georgia and from farm country. Not too far from farm country. You can hit farm country out here in like an hour.
Well, I want to talk about farmers. We're going to talk about that a lot today. And of course, your show, Farmer Wants a Wife, which is in its second season, which has got to be very exciting for you.
Super exciting. Super exciting.
Tell me a little bit about the farmers that you grew up with in Georgia.
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, first of all, let me set the record clear and state that I did not grow up on a farm.
Right.
I did grow up very far in the country in a tiny little town, but I did not grow up on a farm. So farm life is different than general country life, right? But I had family members who did farming, and in the summers we would go there and everybody would make an event out of shelling peas, and we would make an event out of shucking corn and putting up the corn, putting up the vegetables in the freezer, and we'd make an event out of slaughtering a hog, and everything was its own ritualized celebration because so many people got to eat in this way. Beyond that, I also grew up in 4-H, which everybody I'm sure who's listening to this knows what 4-H is, but I will remind folks that it is the largest youth organization in America, and it's been around since 1902, and it began as an agricultural community club for kids. So all that is to say, between the two of those, I definitely grew up around farming, even though we weren't farmers.
Yeah. Well, so who were some of the farmers that you would have encountered? I'm guessing they had small farms around Georgia.
Mm-hmm. I will tell you a story. My favorite farmer was my bus driver. I rode the bus to and from school, and I was far enough from my school that I was like the second person to be picked up and then the second to last kid to be dropped off. But I rode the bus from first grade all the way until, well, in junior high, then my parents started taking me. But all of elementary school I did. And my school bus driver was a precious, sweet, sweet man named Red McKinnon. I don't actually know what his real first name was. Red was not it. He was called that his whole life because he had red hair. But he was a pepper farmer. He grew hot peppers. And he was the sweetest, kindest man. And he would let me sit up beside him, up beside the bus drivers in those old school buses. They had little heaters that were built in to the bus. And he put a little cushion on there. I was like one of the youngest kids on the bus in the first grade. And he would let me crawl and sit on the heater and sit up there beside him while he drove. And we would talk and talk and talk and talk. And he was already up in the mornings because he had already gone and done all of his farm work. And then he'd drive all the kids to school and then get back to it. But he was a dear, dear soul, and rest in peace has passed, obviously. But he was probably one of my most favorite farmer encounters.
And really left an impression on you.
Oh, such kindness. Such kindness. He wasn't one of those school bus drivers. You know how a lot of times school bus drivers can get a bad rap, you know, at times.
Well, they can get cranky.
And I don't blame them. Now that I'm an adult, I see why this happens. But he was never that. And every year at the end of the school year, for those of us, probably the last, I don't know, maybe third of the bus, for those of us who were in the last third of his drop-offs, every year at the end of school, the last day of school, he would drive us into town and take us to the Dairy Queen. And he would buy us all a little treat. Just so sweet. Oh, so sweet.
He knew how to win y'all over.
He sure did. He sure did.
You mentioned 4-H, and I know you've been a spokesperson for them, and you clearly love that organization so much. When you think back to your 4-H days, what was a really proud moment for you with 4-H?
Oh my God. I mean, I love 4-H so much, Sid. I have to tell you, I was a 4-H'er from fifth grade all the way until I graduated high school. The thing that I did that I loved the most in Georgia 4-H was a couple of things. And I did everything from like CPA, DPA, county project and district project achievements whenever you're in fifth and sixth grade. And I also did leadership, like was on the district board and state board when I was in junior high and high school. But the things that I did the most that I love about 4-H is I was a part of a performing arts group out of the Georgia 4-H Club called Clovers and Company. And this was all volunteers, of course, the adults who organized and facilitated and ran the thing. And kids all over the state would audition for this. And you could, from the time you were in the fifth grade to the time you graduated. So it had all ages, and you auditioned, and only a certain amount were chosen. And I auditioned and I was selected. And I did that every year from fifth grade all the way through my high school. And I remember when I did it, I loved it so much. And when I walked in for the first time and I saw all of these kids, because I was from a little town, Douglas, Georgia, Coffee County. It's like we had, you know, you could be in the children's choir, and we had little community theater stuff here and there, but that was really for the adults. And so there wasn't a lot that was offered there at the time. I was in the band, but in terms of singing and acting, there wasn't a lot. And I remember walking in for the first time at Rock Eagle 4-H camp where they hosted this and did all the teaching for the shows that we learned each year. And just seeing all these kids and being like, I have found my people. Like these, they were kids who just loved performing. They just eat, slept, drank, loved it, loved performing. And I would not be doing what I'm doing today as a performer, as an entertainer, if it weren't for that organization. I loved it. I did so much with it, and still actually am a big part of 4-H, and actually connected them with the Farmer Wants a Wife folks. And they're doing some co-promotions for this and supporting each other, which is just so lovely to see. And then the second thing I did in 4-H that I just loved so much is that I was a camp counselor when I was in college at Rock Eagle 4-H Center, which is in Eatonton, Georgia. And getting to be a part of that community and getting to just have fun with kids all summer, it was such a great job. And the camaraderie and the friendships, not to mention obviously the experiences and playing all summer with kids, but the camaraderie and the friendships are what I truly treasure and have friendships, deep, deep friendships still to this day.
I think in some ways, maybe you never really graduated from being a camp counselor.
In many ways, I did not. That is for sure.
Well, I want to talk about the show a little bit more in a minute, but we always talk a little bit about food on this podcast.
Yes, please.
And when you think about the people in your family that could really cook, and it could be aunts, uncles, grandparents, who comes to mind?
Grandmothers and my mother. My great-grandmother, Grandma Bray, Mildred Lee Osteen Bray was her name. We have one little acre of land, and on it was our house and her house, my great-grandparents. And we lived in sort of like a little Scottish clan on the corner of two dirt roads. So it was like us, my great-grandparents, a great-uncle and aunt, another great-uncle and aunt, my maternal great-grandmother. So I had two sets of great-grandparents, not my great-grandfather on one side, but like two sets of great-grandparents right there that walked up and down the road and could see. And it was such a fun freeway to grow up, just like outside all the time. Me and my cousin Josh, that's all we did was just play outside.
So great.
But my Grandma Bray, she was always cooking, and she would always say, well, y'all can come over. I don't know if I got enough. And then it would be like a feast, okay? Because she was accustomed always to cooking for farmhands, because whenever they were in their working years, they were tobacco farmers. And so she would always cook way too much because she was used to cooking for an army of people. And it would be fried chicken. It would be fried Irish potatoes. It would be rice and tomato gravy. It would be cube steak. It would be mashed potatoes. It would be big boy peas and black eyed peas. It would be Ford hooks and turnip greens and butter beans and biscuits. Actually, she made, which I love, she made what she called a hoe cake, which some people call a Johnny hoe cake. But it was basically like a skillet biscuit. Okay.
Right.
It was like a giant biscuit, but just made in a skillet. You didn't put it in the oven. She was just such a great cook. And every afternoon when I would get off that bus that Mr. Red was driving, I would get off and I would go over to her house, and she would have saved me some of the lunch that she made. And I would, of course, immediately eat, because all children are starving when we get home. I don't know why. I would sit on the little, it was an ottoman, but she called it a hassock. She put out the hassock and she put my little plate there, and I'd sit and I'd watch The End of Another World, which was a soap opera at the time.
Yeah.
I'd watch The End of Another World with her, and then I might get to watch a little Tom and Jerry or Mr. Rogers, maybe Electric Company, depending on what the timing was. But yeah, it was such a great way to grow up. But yeah, she was a great cook. My mother is a great cook. She cooks many of the same things that I just shared with you of my grandmother's. Now, she'll also do chicken and dumplings. She does a couple of other healthier options too, not just fried chicken. There's roast chicken, there's turkey, those sorts of things. She does some scalloped potatoes, really desserts. We all love the desserts. I mean, what's not to love? Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. And I'm sure a lot of those recipes have passed down, whether written or not.
And as a matter of fact, my mom and I just did a little passion project a number of years ago. It looks like a little church cookbook that we did that she wanted to put together. My mom's very creative. She wanted to put together all of our favorite recipes she remembered and have that saved and bound and shared. So we had a lot of fun doing that. But also, I would be remiss if I did not mention very specifically my Aunt Kay's banana pudding, which is delicious. Absolutely delicious. She makes it with condensed milk, of course. So if you're worried about your cholesterol, do not look there, but it's delicious.
But if you're worried about cholesterol, you don't need to be worried about anything when you're eating banana pudding. So
there you go. You know.
I thought I read somewhere that you had a grandmother called Buma.
Buma, yeah, that was my father's mother, my dad's mom.
What a great name.
Yeah. So her name was Edith, but we ended up calling her Buma because, you know, as a lot of times it can happen in families, the firstborn grandchild usually names the grandparents. Yeah. And my oldest cousin on that side, her name is Michelle. Hey, Michelle, if you're listening. My grandfather would always come around the corner and try to scare her. Boo, 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 try to scare her. So she started associating him with the word boo. So then that became his name, not only just to her, but to everybody. Okay. Then, of course, it would follow suit that then our grandmother would be called Boo Ma. And Boo Ma.
I love that. I mean, of all the grandmother names, and there's so many great ones, that's a new one. I haven't heard that, and I just love it.
Boo Ma, and she was something else, I'm here to tell you. She was fun and witchy, and she had so many things. She had a wicked sense of humor, and she had a parrot, and she had taught that dang bird to, first of all, it laughed just like her. And she had taught it to say these little fun phrases, ABC, 1, 2, 3, and like just all these little things that she would work with it on. She was quite a character. She was a fun character.
So who was the most musical person in your family other than you?
I mean, there's no one person who had followed specifically a music track. Now, my grandmother, my mom's mom, Nanny is what we called her. she sang in the trio whenever she was growing up, and my mom sang in the choir, and my dad had a fantastic voice. I remember whenever I was little, sitting up in the front, standing up actually beside him in the cab of the truck, and this was no car seats or anything then, Lord help us, how are we even here? Islands in the Stream would be on, and of course he would sing Kenny's part and I would sing Dolly's part, and just listening to music and singing along. I have so many great memories of that. But mostly for me, in addition to those family associations, mostly for me it was in church. That's where I really grew up learning and getting to understand what it is to see people sing with passion and with conviction about something that they believe in. And to this day, it's a litmus that works for me with songwriting and with performing. I have to be able to connect to it in a really spiritual way to be able to feel like it's something that I want to perform.
Yeah. On the music front, Jennifer, I want to ask you about one song. It's a song that I believe has an anniversary, and it's Baby Girl, which I think it came out 20 years ago. So the idea behind that song, you know, for the three people out there who may not know it, is a songwriter who's writing home to her family. And she says, "Dear Mom and Dad, please send money." And you were in a very different place in your life and in your career at that time. And I'm just curious, what does that song mean to you now?
That song means so much. I mean, first of all, I'm grateful, so grateful for that song. And because of that song, Sugarland went on to have such great success and really form a career. And then I think in terms of the story that is reflected in that song, I know that there was a part of me and a part of us in writing that we were manifesting of what we wanted it to be and the kind of story that we wanted and the kind of success that we wanted, and to be able to share that success and also share that pride with the people that we love the most and take care of our people when we are taken care of too. That song to me is such a gift and represents a part of me that is very alive and well, you know, which is my dreamer. I have a huge dreamer, and the dreams have shifted and changed throughout my life and grown and evolved, but that baby girl is still here for sure.
Dear Mom and Dad, please send money. I'm so broke that it ain't funny. Well, I don't need much, just enough to get me through.
Well, it's such a great song, and I know people just want to hear it every time you get up on a stage, probably to this day.
They do. They do, and I love that they do.
After the break, I'll talk more with Jennifer Nettles about the new season of her show, Farmer Wants a Wife, her upcoming album, and the evolution of country music. Welcome back to Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living. I'm Sid Evans, and today I'm talking with the award-winning musician and actress, Jennifer Nettles. All right, well, let's talk about the show, Farmer Wants a Wife, for a minute. I mean, this is not a new show. It's new to the U.S., but it's been around for quite a while.
13 years all over the world.
Right, started in Britain before coming here, and it's basically a dating show where you're matching farmers to women who are not farmers, right? For
correct.
For the most part.
Probably 85% of them are either from the city or definitely not farm life.
So it's really one of the more successful shows globally in this kind of genre. I mean, what is the magic behind this concept?
A few things. I think the way that this show has promoted and propagated and created an outlet for authenticity, for authentically looking for love. Okay. When this first came across my desk, I was like, immediately like, dating show? No thanks. Because I don't watch them. I think they are highly dramatized, like they're way overly dramatic, and it's just for people to get on there and behave badly and get 15 seconds of fame and become Instagram influencers or something. It's not my favorite.
Right.
So at first I was like, yeah, no thanks. And then they came back and shared a bit of their record. And from this show, over the past 13 years, they've had over 200 marriages and over 500 children as a result of this show. And when I saw that, I sat up and was like, wait a minute, did I see this right? You know? And sure enough, yeah, those are the successes that they have had. And that got my attention enough to watch a few episodes. It is heartwarming. It is endearing. And the success of the show is about looking for true love. And that is why it has been so successful. It's people who are willing to ask the questions, put themselves in a unique circumstance. You know, I mean, with the television cameras there, that's definitely unique. And for these farmers, they bring back five ladies onto their farm to live with them, for those women to get to see and if they take to farm life and what it's all about, and for them to get to see how those women might acclimate to farm life. That's not common. You don't really have five women in your house, right? So unique circumstances, but all looking for love in the ways that we would all want to. And in ways, frankly, that now, man, the more I learn about the younger people and how they have to date with all these apps, I don't think it's truly connective. You would think that with the internet and all of this social media that we can connect with anyone in the world. No, you can maybe share hellos and information, but to really connect, especially to the level that you would want to with someone that you might consider being your partner for your life, no, that ain't gonna happen on the phone. Not at first. I think it's gonna take a lot more than that. And this show just cuts right through that.
So Jennifer, not everybody ends up getting married on this show. So it's not really a success for everybody.
No.
But what do you think some of the women have learned about themselves and about what it takes to be a farmer just going through this process?
I mean, I think not only do the women get to learn this, but I think those of us who are watching get to learn as well, if you're not familiar. And as a matter of fact, on some press that I was doing today with all the farmers, one of them shared that in addition to the fun fish out of water moments for a lot of these ladies who get in there and they're in mud up to their waist, or they're trying to do something with livestock that's freaking them out, or, oh my gosh, are their nails going to break, or whatever it may be. In addition to all those moments, there's a lot of really informative moments where these women get to realize, oh, this isn't just a lifestyle. This is a job, and it's not a regular job, and it's not a 9-to-5 job. You know, if you're a cattle farmer, the cows don't care if it's cold. They don't care if you're sick. They still need the same things.
Right.
And they need it at all times, day or night, whatever. They need it when they need it, you know? So I think everybody, even watching, will get an appreciation for what it is to be a farmer, not just a quaint hashtag that you might put on your social media, hashtag farm life. Okay, maybe, but that there's a difference between that and really what these gentlemen do.
Yeah. I want to switch to country music for a second and music in general. I know that there are a lot of people that have been looking forward to your next album, and I believe you have something that you've been working on that's called Timeless. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that you care to share about that project and what's in the works.
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, for anybody who has been a fan of mine throughout the course of my career, what you continue to see is that I can't sit still and that I love expansion. I love mixing it up. I love doing different things. And while I am super, super proud of all the music I've created in my past, I don't just stop there. I want to continue to grow as an artist. And sometimes people who are real fans of just me and my artistry, they like that. And sometimes people who are just radio fans sometimes don't get into everything that I do musically outside of what would be on the radio. All that is to say, Timeless is a record that I wrote and recorded with a friend of mine named Noel Chacris. He is a Latino artist, and we have written these beautiful, soaring, most of them romantic ballads in Spanish and English. We wrote a whole record in Spanish and English, and I can't wait to share it. I feel like people don't really write love songs much anymore, and This is definitely an album of love songs, and it's big, big singing and big, big joy and passion. And the plan is that we're going to put that out this year. So musically, that'll probably be what you see from me next.
Well, you keep us posted, okay?
I will do that. I will do that.
Looking back, we were talking about kind of the early days of Sugarland and earlier in your career. And one thing that has remained constant from where I'm sitting is that you've been a force for change in country music. And you've brought attention to inequity with female artists, and you've supported the LGBTQ community and so many other important changes that need to happen. And when you look back to the early 2000s, when you and Sugar Land were just blowing up, how would you characterize the differences in country music between then and now?
I mean, I could characterize it in a lot of different ways. I think back at that time, we were just coming off the heels of what was an amazing career for women in both pop and country. We're talking the Shania Twains, the Faith Hills, the Martina McBrides, the Kathy Mateas, the Mary Chapin Carpenters, the Jody Messinas, on and on, that women were very present and very celebrated in the genre at that time. And since that time, the evolution has continued to expand. Also, we had the Dixie Chicks at that time, you know, so sonically, it was a very exciting time to be coming onto the scene, I have to tell you. It was a very exciting time. And one of the things that actually drew me to the project itself, because Sugarland started as a writing project, we didn't know where it was going to go. One of the things that drew me to it is that at the time in pop music, things seemed to be leaning more towards like Britney Spears. It was kids, it was pop, it was music that while I love like anybody else, that didn't feel like me. I felt like we had seen this before in Madonna, or we had seen it in Cher, certain other pop artists, that people can tend to get really, what's a word that I could use? Just like really pigeonholed, right? As for who they could be and how they could evolve, even though obviously those women had a myriad of different images. But I didn't see that happening as much in like the Britneys and the Christina Aguileras, et cetera, in pop. And I loved the stories that country music was telling. I'd grown up on country music, of course, even though I like everything. So for me, I was drawn to country music at that time because it was a place that a singer-songwriter could really tell stories. And it felt like a good match. And luckily, it took off. But all that is to say, I continue to see it evolve musically in terms of, you know, always there has been a dance between country music and pop music. It used to be, when you think about Elvis, he would do the blues, he would do gospel, he would pull from all these different influences. So did Johnny Cash when he talks about his song Shoe Shine, and he talks about the little kid who was shining the shoes and the rhythm that he had, and that inspired his guitar rhythm at the time. So an artist is an artist no matter where she is, no matter where he is, and she's finding inspiration through other people that inspire her. And so we've always, as country musicians, been influenced by all different other genres. But I definitely see that expanding. You hear way more rap influence now in country than you ever did. I mean, when Christian and I did Stuck Like Glue, we had that little rap snippet in it for those listening that remember that, whoa, whoa, you almost failed, two stuck together from the ATL. Okay, so there, that was scandalous at the time. Sid, certain radio stations edited it out without even asking our permission. They edited that part out. I was incandescent about that, okay? But now everybody's rapping, especially all the dudes. Yeah. So it's interesting to watch that evolution. That's on one side of commercial country. Then you have the fantastic, more like blues and Americana stuff. You've got your Chris Stapletons, you've got your Jason Isbells, you've got those ones that feel much more classic in that way. Zach Bryan, you know. So it continues to evolve, and it's always going to. And there are always going to be the factions of those people who are like, oh, it's too pop, it's not country anymore. And there are always going to be the diehards who are like, I've got to have it like this or it's not country. Okay, like you all make up a beautiful tapestry of what is country music. So musically, it's evolved in a lot of ways from an activism perspective, as you mentioned that, you know, still way, way struggling and way, way behind in terms of equity for women. I mean, is it better? I don't know. The conversations are being had. I definitely see more people of color than I ever have before. So things are evolving and they'll hopefully continue to do it. And it'll never be fast enough for some of us. You have to keep being true to yourself and true to your heart and trying to pave the way and open the doors for those to come behind you for that next little baby girl who has a dream. You have to keep paving the way and opening the door for her.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I look forward to seeing where you take this next and hearing the new album. I can't wait to hear that.
Thank you.
Jennifer, I just have one more question for you. What does it mean to you to be Southern?
I love being Southern. I think that one of our biggest pieces of our culture, I've got to say peaches from Georgia. How about that? Did you like, well, it was like a Freudian slip. One of the biggest pieces of our culture that I love is that we are joyous. We are full of gratitude. We can laugh at most everything, even the inappropriate, even the sad. And I think that that is a real resilience. I think we are a resilient culture of people. I think we are a diverse culture of people. I love, even though we have a sad and unfortunate part of our history, the ways that cultures have informed each other to become what is Southern culture, I think is really, really beautiful. And I celebrate being Southern, and I enjoy the opportunity to show people what it really is to be Southern. People have a stereotype, you know, they want to think that it's all ignorance, deliverance with the banjo, right? And it's not. We are a fun, loving, warm, happy, joyous group of people and culture. And I'm super proud to be Southern.
Well, beautifully said. And I have so much more I'd love to talk to you about sometime. So I hope you'll come back.
Yes, I would love that. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Nettles, thanks for being on Biscuits and Jam.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Jennifer Nettles. Southern Living is based in Birmingham, Alabama. Be sure to follow Biscuits and Jam on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And we would love your feedback. If you could rate this podcast and leave us a review, we'd appreciate it. You can also find us online at southernliving.com/biscuitsandjam. Our theme song is by Sean Watkins of Nickel Creek. I hope you'll join me next time when I'll be talking with the American Idol sensation and granddaughter of Loretta Lynn, Emmy Russell. We'll see you then.